Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna. 2017 in Johannesburg, open questions and answers.
Thank you. Please come in, there's cushions and space. Okay. Hare Krishna.
Yes, come in, otherwise I can't see you there. And I won't be happy. Come sit down.
Thank you for coming today. This is, in fact, our very first Bhakti Lounge Joburg program, and we're very honored and pleased to have Mother Irmila presenting at our first Bhakti Lounge program. And I just wanted to tell you a little bit about what Bhakti Lounge Joburg is about. Basically, we're planning to open a small yoga center in Melville and Auckland Park later on this year. And part of what Bhakti Lounge hopes to do is an extension of what we, at least most of us, got at through the BYS system at university. So the primary focus of Bhakti Lounge is training for both guys and ladies in sadhana bhakti, in building community within bhakti, and basically how to find your place in bhakti. And I think it's very apt that today's talk or sort of get together, we entitled it Finding Your Place in Bhakti. So today is basically quite informal. For those who were at the BYS program yesterday, it was an open floor discussion. It was an open floor discussion, and those who were there had questions, that burning questions that they wanted to ask about Bhakti Yoga and how they can find their place in Bhakti Yoga, the confusions that they had, the doubts, or you know, wanted to sort of understand something a little bit better. So today is going to be more of that, and please feel free to ask any burning questions that you have.
Have to be burning.
any questions that you have. A big part of what we were trying to do at Bhakti Lounge is to establish a culture of mentorship, of community and camaraderie with each other as devotees. So please feel free to ask those questions. I don't know if you have any sort of opening remarks, Mother Irmila, or do you want us to jump straight into the opening floor?
No, we could talk a little bit. We have the we're going to have the theme of finding our place in bhakti, right? So it's kind of interesting because the acharyas and the shastra, they give us a different, let's see, I closed it already. I think I've identified over 20 different ways of understanding the progress in bhakti. And if we think about finding our place in bhakti, we could be looking at that, the demarcations on the journey, the unfolding of the flower of love of God in the heart. But we can also think about finding our place in bhakti, meaning not so much what's going on internally in my consciousness and how do I progress in my consciousness, but, all right, how do I now bring the external practices of bhakti into my life? You know, when I joined the Hare Krishna movement, there was a very simple answer to that. You drop every single thing in your life, and you move into the temple with one little bag of stuff. So you didn't have to integrate the practices of bhakti into your life. You didn't have a life anymore. You basically just lived in an ashram. And, of course, that was not very practical for most people long term. And nor would that be a good strategy if we want to bring Krishna consciousness to the world. We'd have to have a pretty big ashram. You know, it would be a little difficult. So that's another way when we think about finding my place in bhakti, which would mean how do I become an integrated person with my studies or my career or my family, whatever other responsibilities we have or whatever else is making up our life, and how do I bring bhakti into that? Another way we could think of how do I find my place in bhakti, and actually we should include in that first one, how do I also bring bhakti out to others? So not just how do I include it in my own life, but how do I function as a giver of bhakti? And then the last one would be more, how do I find my place within the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, the worldwide Hare Krishna movement, which is, all three of those are separate questions. They're interrelated. They have something to do with each other. And how you answer one question has some effect on how you will answer the other questions, but they are still three separate questions. They're not the same question. I think it's extremely important to understand that they are three separate questions. How do I find my place in terms of my internal development of consciousness? Because this is, after all, about Krishna consciousness. How do I have the external practices of bhakti? How do I kind of arrange my life in bhakti? And the other is, how do I function with the International Society for Krishna Consciousness? What's my position there? What's my relationship there? I find it will help very much if you keep those three things as related but still separate questions. And I have found a lot of difficulty comes when we conflate those questions because they're not the same thing. They have a relationship to each other, but they're not the same. And that's something that I think will help you in general. So that's my opening, as you put it so formally, my opening remarks. I feel like I'm at a steak dinner or something.
Can I go first?
You can go first. It's your house. You get the privilege.
Well, I've often been asked the question about balancing career, professional. A lot of new devotees and devotees who have literally just begun in Krishna consciousness often view, pursuing or even taking up your career and your professional life as quote unquote maya, as a distraction to the core business of Krishna consciousness. And I've seen a lot of young devotees in particular grapple with this. Could you maybe explain what action in action is a little, or explain maybe the secret?
Well, first of all, this misunderstanding isn't just something that's happening today in 2017. It was a misunderstanding that Arjuna had in the Bhagavad Gita. It was one of his prime misunderstandings in the Bhagavad Gita, where he says, okay, Krishna, you're telling me to do Buddha Yoga, the yoga of intelligence, and you're telling me not to do anything abominable, and then you're telling me to get up and fight this war. And that doesn't seem to make any sense to me. He couldn't put those two things together. It took quite a while before Arjuna could even seem to grasp the theoretical idea of that. And especially when Krishna has a whole chapter about meditative yoga, and he says, just leave the society and don't talk to anybody and be celibate. I don't know if you know about Arjuna's family configuration. It was very unusual. Are you familiar with the Pandavas family configuration? So, his main wife, Draupadi, had four other husbands. A polyandry situation. Five brothers. She was married to all five brothers. And each brother also had at least one other wife. So it was a really polyandrous family. A very unusual family. So Arjuna had two other wives besides Draupadi, and Draupadi had four other husbands besides Arjuna. So it was kind of strange that Krishna is saying, go in the forest and be a celibate. And, you know, just sit and meditate and chant Omkara and stare at the tip of your nose. And, you know, and that was even more confusing for Arjuna. And Arjuna says, I can't do that. I don't know how to do that. That's not going to work with my life. And again, it didn't go together with what Krishna was telling Arjuna. You know, stand up and fight this battle, and you guys are meant to be the rulers of the planet. So we have the same kind of idea that somehow or other, you know, if I want to take up Krishna consciousness, then I should just walk away from everything. I shouldn't have a family. I shouldn't have a career. And Arjuna is kind of interesting because he has this, you know, sort of a super family. he's much more entangled in family than most of us. Of course, all his family members were great saintly persons. And he had a very demanding career also. He was the prince of the world empire. And then he was a soldier also, which is a very mentally demanding career. It's not like something where, you know, you can just kind of space out of your computer for an hour a day and the rest of the time you can chant Hare Krishna. You know, you're out on the battlefield. So yeah, very demanding from both a family position and a career position. But Krishna wasn't telling him to give those up, although there seems to be points in the Gita where he is telling him to do that. And Arjuna was really confused. How do I do this? So I think this is an old question. You know, we can look at the Hare Krishna movement historically and say it started off as an ashram-based organization, and therefore we have this mentality that Krishna consciousness means dropping everything, which is exactly what I did when I was 18. I dropped out of college, and, you know, I gave my car to my dad, and I took one tiny little suitcase full of stuff. I didn't even know if I should bring, you know, shampoo. And I just lived in a room with 12 other women. So, you know, we can look at ISKCON's historical roots and say, well, that mentality is still there, but it's a problem from the beginning that people think that spiritual life must mean that I renounce the world on an external level. And in every religious tradition, people do that. People have done it, you know, in our tradition, if you think of, you know, Raghunath Das Goswami did that, and Narottam Das Thakur, and Lord Chaitanya himself did that. They all renounced the world. And some of them did. All three of those people did that quite young. Where they renounced family and career. So there's some validity to that. But if that was all that spiritual life meant for anybody, you wouldn't be able to have a spiritual society. If you think about it for a minute. If everybody who wanted to attain to spiritual consciousness walked away from career and family and just took care of their own enlightenment in some sort of a monastery or a convent or, you know, up in a mountaintop, something like that, who would be running the world? Who would be giving knowledge in the universities? Who would be running the countries? Who would be running the businesses, who would be, you know, producing music and art and theater and gardens and who and furniture, who would be doing all those things? And the people who would be doing those things would then be unenlightened people. Now, if unenlightened people are running the world is not a particularly nice place to be in. As we can see right now, when unenlightened people overall are running the world. You know, it's the political systems of the world are being run by unenlightened people. Maybe there's an exception here and there, I don't know about. And, you know, the universities are run, again, generally by unenlightened people, with a few exceptions. I know some enlightened college professors. But generally speaking, businesses are certainly run by unenlightened people. Otherwise, we wouldn't find the destruction of the environment. And even the arts are run by unenlightened people. The people doing music and dance and theater and sports, and they're not using their talents to bring people to spirituality. They're using their talents to degrade people. And even just, you know, these chairs are probably made in a factory. they're probably not the result of anybody's love and care. And it's probably, they're probably not offerings of love. They're probably just mechanized. So Krishna has a desire that we also spiritualize the world. It's his world. If everybody just walks away from it. Like Robert says, if you go to a garden and you just say, oh, this is all false, the gardener will be depressed. He says, don't depress Krishna. This is, it's also his world. He's here, and he cares. So while it's appropriate for some people not to have a family and career, that is, it's an appropriate and valid path. If everybody does that, then Krishna's not going to be happy. And we're then lacking in compassion. You know, at least some of us need to do that. And the other reason that some or most of us need to do it is that we're not actually qualified to renounce the world. So usually we just look at it from that point of view. We say, well, if you're really spiritually qualified, you'll renounce the world. And the only reason to have a career and a family is because you're so unqualified. But the other is true too. Even if you were qualified, you might still do it as a service. But the reality is that most of us aren't qualified to do it anyway. So if you put those things together, that Krishna wants it done as a service, and that most of us are qualified for that and not qualified for something else, then there shouldn't be this big conflict between the two. So how to deal with it is something that Krishna talks about a lot in the Bhagavad Gita. And mostly the way he talks about it is by not seeing a separation between your career and your Krishna consciousness. If not, you know, people ask always about how do I balance things. I think they're talking about more just how do they prioritize their time in what they're doing. But it's also this idea that somehow when I'm at work or I'm at school, that I can't be in the same consciousness I can be in during a kirtan or during my japa or during my reading. And that is just not true. So I like when Krishna says to Arjuna, Yam Yam Vapi Svam Bhavam, Bhagavad Gita 8:6, where he says, whatever you think about at the time of death determines your next body. And then the very next verse, 8:7, he says, Mam Anusmara Yujacha, think of me while you're fighting. Yeah, so there's Krishna himself is saying to you, whatever you're thinking about at the time of death, that's where you're going to go. And I could die at any minute. So I should just sit down and meditate 24/7. And then he says, no, meditate on me while you're fighting. And fighting, I mean, I haven't had to do any fighting in this lifetime. Thankfully. Never had anybody try to kill me and never was trying to kill anybody else. Hopefully it doesn't happen. Hopefully I make it to the end of this life without being in a war. But I can imagine that it would be pretty intense experience. There's plenty of room. I would imagine it would take a tremendous amount of focus. Right? If somebody's trying to kill me, and I'm trying not to be killed and to kill them, I would imagine, wouldn't you imagine that would take pretty much every bit of your mental concentration? In fact, Arjuna was famous for extreme mental concentration. Do you know the story of the bird? Do you know that story? So Arjuna's teacher taught not only a lot of students, but he also taught his own son. And his son complained that you like Arjuna better than you like me. And so the teacher said, it's not that I like Arjuna better than I like you, but he's a better student. So I'm responding to you in the classroom, I'm responding to you both as students. So the teacher's son was, I don't believe he's a better student. He said, okay, I'll show you. So the teacher took like a little, you know, plastic in those days, but some sort of a toy bird, and he hung it in a tree. And he asked each of the students to come up. And he says, get out your bow and arrow and aim at the bird. So I take out the bow and arrow and they get in there. Archer stance. And then he say, okay, what do you see? And so some of the students, and we do this kind of thing too. Oh, my dear teacher, I see your divine feet. I see your divine form. We give the answer we think we're supposed to give. I see the sun and the creation and the bird and the tree. Okay, thank you. Sit down. And each student came up and they put the arrow in the bow. And each one of them, what do you see? And some of them say, oh, my dear teacher, I see the bird in the tree. Good. Sit down. And Arjuna comes up and says, what do you see? He says, my dear teacher, I see the eye of the bird. You see anything else? No. You see the form of the bird? No, just the eye. So this was the kind of focus. And then the teacher turned to his son and said, see? He's a better student than you. So this was the kind of focus that Arjuna had. Amazing focus. And still Krishna said to him, think of me while you fight. So the main way that we deal with career as devotees is we think of Krishna while we're in our career. And this is also explained, that was in the 8th chapter, in the 4th chapter. Krishna says that when you're in the proper consciousness, the person making the offering, what they're offering, the fire that consumes the offering, everything becomes spiritual. So this kind of thinking that, you know, spiritual life means the time I spend chanting, and career is my material life. Krishna's cutting that right in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. That's not correct. So then the question becomes, how do you think of Krishna while you're at your career? Well, ultimately, the way we think of Krishna while we're working, or going to school, or washing your dishes, or washing your car, or whatever. It doesn't have to be career. Is you have love. Because we naturally think about whatever we love. We think about our attachments. If you observe your thoughts, spend 5 minutes just kind of watching your thoughts, you think about what you have attachment to. We all do. And a positive or negative attachment. We're thinking about what we're worried about. You know, so what we have positive attachment to, we're excited about. I'm going back to the U.S. a week from yesterday. And I'll stop by and see my oldest son. I haven't seen him for a year. So I think about it, especially the last week or so. I'm going to see my son, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that. My thoughts go there because I have attachment. Do you understand? Yes? And then my thoughts go to where I'm worried. How's this going to happen? How is this going to work? And do I need this? And do I need that? So the main way we think about Krishna is if we are invested in Krishna. If we emotionally feel, not just intellectually, that everything I depend on for my happiness is in Krishna. Because what we're thinking about is our investments. Does that make sense to you? I really saw this principle with my daughter. So she was a mutual friend introduced her to her now husband before they got married. And when they were introduced, they weren't in the same geographical location. They were, in fact, quite far apart. Her then-future husband was in California, on the west coast of America, and she was in North Carolina, on the east coast of America. So they just saw each other's pictures, and they talked on the phone, and they wrote each other letters, and then he was making a plan to come visit her and to meet her. And there was a three-week gap between when they first talked on the phone and when he came to meet her. And during that time, she was a teacher. She was a teacher in a primary school. And she told me that she was thinking about him all day long. She said even when she was teaching difficult subjects that normally required all of her attention to teach, that she thought about him anyway. It was like parallel thought. There was a focus on what she was doing, but there was also the thought of him. So, we all have experience like that. we all have experienced that no matter how focused we are with what we're doing, if there's somebody or something that's really pulling us emotionally, we're able to have a consciousness on that person or that thing or that activity or whatever simultaneously. And people around us think that we're just focused on what we're doing. So that's ultimately what Bhakti Yoga is about, that I develop my emotional attachment and my desires for Krishna. That's what Krishna says in the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, that the purpose of sadhana bhakti or abhyas yoga, practice yoga, is to develop ichha, to develop a desire. The desire is already there. It's a natural desire. Okay, so you can say, well, that's a little tough for me right now. So Krishna also gives many ways of thinking about him in relationship to what we're already thinking about. Like it's a little hot in here. And Krishna says, I am the heat, fire. So the warmth we're feeling in this room, that warmth is actually Krishna. He says, I'm the light in all luminous objects. The light in this room is actually Krishna. He says, I'm human ability. So our ability to be sitting, that we're not just falling over, our ability to see, to hear, to think, that is Krishna. He says, our intelligence is him. And he gives a list in the 7th chapter, the 9th chapter, the 10th chapter, and the 15th chapter, of ways that we can meditate on him with the things we're already thinking about. We're already thinking about, it's hot. Our thought already goes there, yes? Already goes there. Oh, that he is Krishna. Our thought already goes to, you know, I'm thirsty. Our consciousness already goes there. And then, okay, Krishna is the water. He is the taste of water. So it's just taking what we're already thinking about, all beautiful, opulent, glorious, splendorous things, and instead of thinking about them only and solely in relationship to our bodily and mental and emotional and social desires and needs, we also think about them in relationship to Krishna. Then we look at the whole concept of spiritualization of career specifically. So those two things are general. Having some emotion for Krishna is a general thing for anybody, anywhere. It's not just with career. And having everything in the world spark consciousness of Krishna, be an impetus for consciousness of Krishna, is again not specific to career. If we want to go specific to career, then we have to go somewhat out of bhakti proper, and we go to the science of Varnashram. So Varnashram is not, it's not bhakti. It's really how to deal in the world. It's a science of how to deal in the world. And of the two, Varnashram, Varna means occupation. What is your career? What is your livelihood? And so the Bhagavatam especially, a little bit in the Bhagavad Gita, but much more in the Bhagavatam, gives principles of how you can spiritualize career. Specifically, career. So, one of the principles is that your career should, if at all possible, be in alignment with your psychophysical nature. And many people don't do this. They do a career just to make money, and then hopefully they can spend some time every day or every week doing something they actually love. And this separation of career from what you're good at and what you love has caused a lot of pain in society. So the first principle of Varna is that what's your nature should also be your source of income. And we could easily speak for a week on how to find your nature, just as a very, very simple thing, is what makes you feel alive, what makes you feel energized. What kind of work makes you feel energized? And you can look at broad categories. Do I like working with people? Do I like working with big groups, small groups? Do I like working just with tasks? Do I like working with knowledge? Do I like working with taking care of people? Do I like working with animals, with plants, with natural resources? Do I like working with the arts, with the skills, and serving people? You know, do I like creating wealth? Or do I like redistributing wealth? What kind of things do I like to do? Do I like to be in charge? Do I like to have somebody else in charge? Do I like to work as part of a team? Do I like everything laid out for me step by step? Or do I want to just have some general idea where I'm going and I figure it out? You know, all these are all components of what is my nature. And our livelihood should be something that's in accord with our nature. Where even materially, where we enjoy the work so much that we forget about eating and sleeping. So that's the first principle of Varna. Then the next principle of Varna should be just common sense. Protect the source of your wealth rather than exploit it. It's just like, you know, the story of the goose who laid the golden egg and the guy didn't want to feed the goose, right? You all know that story? The guy had a goose that laid a golden egg and he said, you know, it's nice that I get the golden eggs, but I got to feed the thing. So let me just cut it in half and then I can just get the eggs without feeding the thing. So nowadays, generally, people exploit the source of their own wealth. Now, if you exploit the source of your own wealth, that's very short-sighted. You should take care of the source of your own wealth. So if what's maintaining you is knowledge, if you work in the knowledge sector, then you should protect knowledge. You should make sure it's not being distorted. You know, there's every once in a while there's articles published about how in science and even in medicine that people falsify data and make something up just so they can get an article published. They make up studies so they can bring some medicine to the public and make billions on it, even though it's hurting people. Yes, you read the references. It's horrifying. Or if people, you know, if they're getting their wealth from the earth, they've spread the earth with pesticides and fertilizers. They destroy the fertility of the soil, which is providing their own wealth. Like torturing the animals, you know, just on and on and on. Or governments that instead of protecting the people who are paying their taxes, they exploit the people who are paying their taxes. Eventually the people are going to say, we don't want to pay taxes to you anymore. Right? Or you exploit the skills, like we were saying, mechanizing skills. Or you're using the arts to degrade people. And if you degrade people, they're not going to care so much about art and beauty anymore, are they? So to protect the source of your own wealth, to be a protector, not to be an exploiter. And then the next thing is to see your livelihood as part of the whole. So in sociology, we call this functionalism. In sociology, there's two main ways of viewing the social body. One is called functionalism and one is called critical theory or conflict theory. Functionalism is that each of us has a role to play in the social body and on the planet and the universe, just like each organ in our body has a particular role to play, and it's a very synergistic role. The different organs help each other and work with each other, and in one sense, no one organ is particularly more important than another. You could say the heart and the brain are the most important, or the heart and the brain and the lungs or something like that, but I don't think any of us would want to be on long-term kidney dialysis because our kidneys didn't work. You know, it's, how do you really say that, well, one organ is better than another? They're all important. Nobody wants to lose one of their bodily organs. So functionalism is like that, and critical theory or conflict theory sees the social body as an exploitive, competitive situation. And generally either between some sort of social classes or between genders. So either like a Marxist idea that it's conflict between the economic haves and have-nots, or a feminist idea that it's a conflict between men and women, or a combination of the two. And they see the world as an aggressive place, and they see the occupations as something where it's oppressors and oppressed. Prabhupada writes about this in Krishna book. He says, materialists see the world as very aggressive, but to the devotees, everything is very happy. So the Bhagavatam definitely puts forward a functional view, not a conflict theory. So to see your occupation as, what is my role? How do I contribute? How does my occupation contribute not just to me? Because the first two could just be me. I do what I love, and I protect instead of exploit the sources of my wealth. But the next principle is, how does my livelihood help everybody else? And there's a lot of research that show if you do a livelihood that doesn't have, that you don't perceive as having value, you're not going to be happy with it. So how, what is my role? And if you look at your occupation and say there's no role, there's no purpose. I had a friend who was selling cosmetics that were useless. They were completely useless. And one of her employees left, and so she asked me to help her. So I did it as a favor to her. But it was just so depressing, because everything we were selling was useless. And so many people were making money at each step, you know. So we were selling something for, you know, 1,000 times inflated, the actual worth of the thing. And you didn't even need the stupid thing anyway. So, you know, the next principle of occupation is, what is the value you're offering? And another principle of occupation is to do it as a sacrifice for Krishna, to offer it in sacrifice for Krishna. Not just that you're giving benefit to the whole society, you're giving benefit to the planet, but that you're offering it as a loving sacrifice for Krishna. Now, what does that involve? That involves, well, using some of the fruit of your labor, whether it's cash or whether it's tomatoes or whatever it may be, using some of the fruit of your labor directly to offer to Krishna, using the talents in your career also in Krishna service, finding ways within the scope of your career to spread Krishna consciousness, whether it's that's openly or whether it's in a clandestine way is not so terribly important, but finding some way to use your career to spread love of God. So if you do those four principles of career, what is in harmony with your nature, protecting the source of your wealth rather than exploiting it, doing something that has valuable, is valuable to this whole social body, not just for yourself, or just for yourself and your family, and then offering things as a sacrifice. So if you take those four principles that are specific to career, and you combine them with the general principles of Krishna consciousness, that I should become conscious of Krishna everywhere because I love him, and that I should become conscious of Krishna because when I look at my computer screen, he's the light in the luminous objects. And because when I talk to my coworkers, he's in everyone's heart. That when you put that together, you don't really have a separation between Krishna consciousness and career. Now, if your real question is about prioritizing the time, that's another question. If that was your actual question, I didn't touch on it at all.
I just wanted to make sure everyone gets in their questions as well, so feel free to do that.
Yes.
This might be maybe a personal or specific question to my career. I'm an educator in training, and I know that you are as well. How could I spiritualize the classroom? We have diverse students in our classroom. And they all come with their different mindsets and everything. But at that age, we are still trying to mold them to be better grown-ups, better humans for them. Yeah. By spiritualizing and enlightening minds, is it even possible?
Well, you want to help children, because most people are going to school for a large reason, to be prepared for a career. So you want to teach them those four principles of career. Help them to find what makes them feel alive. Help them to find their nature. And help them to think about career as something in line with their nature. Train them to be protectors rather than exploiters.
In terms of spirituality, or do I just find it?
Well, those two things are not spiritual. As I said, Varnashram is not spiritual in and of itself. But it forms a basis for spirituality. If you're not working in accord with your nature and you're exploiting the sources of your own sustenance, spiritual consciousness is difficult. So it's not impossible. It's possible in any situation, but it's more difficult. So you want to train them in those four things, to see themselves as part. How do I help others? how do I find my value and sense of worth in giving? And then how to sacrifice for God. And if you can't, you know, if you're in a situation where you can't teach about a specific faith, or if you can't even speak about faith in any specific way, then try to find a way that you can communicate it with the language that's available to you. And then, in addition to that, if you're personally there in consciousness of Krishna, that's not nothing. The everything connected with a person who's in a higher consciousness is purifying to people around them. So, I mean, somebody who's on a very high level like Srila Prabhupada, just to see somebody like that, just to touch somebody like that, just to be in the atmosphere of someone like that, it's not an inconsequential thing. It's not a nothing. Just like, you know, sometimes you walk into a room where people just had a bad argument, and as soon as they hear somebody coming, they stop and they start smiling. But you know that there was an argument in the room. Yes? You can feel it. And you can feel when you walk into an atmosphere when there's a lot of affection. Yes? Can't you? Our consciousness is not, I mean, on a subtle science level, our subtle body, the energy of our subtle body does extend beyond our gross body. You know that, yes? So you can have a huge effect on the children just by being a person of higher consciousness. You should teach them those things. It should be, you know, the basic principles of your classroom. You know, you don't always have to say, wow, I can feel Krishna's the heat in this room. But become aware of it and feel it. And when you see the ability in your students, oh, there's Krishna, he's the ability in that person. And, you know, if you read Krishna book and you read about Krishna's pastimes, especially if you're dealing with young people, their activities can remind you of Krishna. Even their difficult, naughty activities can remind you of Krishna. When I was working in a government school one year, the school had a really good physical education program. And there was one time when the students were doing some sort of demonstration of coordinated gymnastics. And I just started thinking about Krishna's dancing pastime. Is that all right?
Yes, thank you.
Yes?
I just had a question. You know, you spoke about parallel thought, and then you also spoke about Arjuna's focus, that he could just see the eye of the bird. When we have this parallel thought, does it not take away the focus we could have if we were just focused on one thing?
Didn't seem to do that for Arjuna, did it? That's what the mind says to us. The mind says, you're not going to be able to be absorbed in Krishna consciousness and be focused on what you're doing. You have to choose. But that isn't what Krishna says. Now, it is true that Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he said he had three states of consciousness, external, internal, and mixed. So when he was completely in internal consciousness, he was often in a yogic trance of samadhi, where he was not interacting with the world at all. But even when he was in external consciousness, even when it wasn't mixed, he was always saturated with Krishna consciousness. Srila Prabhupada was very practical and focused in the world. But it's not that his only time he was in Krishna consciousness was when he was sitting having a bhajan. And when he was talking about building a temple or managing the accounts, he wasn't in Krishna consciousness anymore. We all do it. Do you have any children?
No.
Anybody here have any children? Pregnant women are very good at doing this.
when you're pregnant, you're always conscious of your baby. Always. And you're doing all kinds of things. But that awareness is always there. It doesn't go away. We definitely know how to do this. We do it whenever there's strong attachment. Suppose you're making it. Do you cook? You don't cook either. What do you do?
My job.
In general. Pick something. Something that you do. Like that you're good at.
I like gardening.
Gardening. Okay. Are you married?
No.
Do you live with your parents?
My brother and mom.
You live with your brother? So, when you're gardening, what are you going to use the stuff you're growing for?
I just plant stuff that I like.
And what's going to happen to it?
It's mostly flowers and herbs and stuff.
And what do you do with the flowers?
Use Krishna.
Okay. Can you focus on the flowers and at the same time feel that you're growing them for Krishna?
Yeah. Just that I had this one experience where when I woke up this morning and listening to some kirtan, like when I got to work, I felt like I lost that potency that I normally have to just get done with things, really just execute them.
It'll come back. Sometimes what happens is the things that we do in this world are so wrapped up with our false ego and our pride. There's sometimes, this doesn't happen to everybody, but it's not uncommon, that sometimes they're all intertwined like this. And sometimes in the process of extricating them, we go through a time that we feel that we don't have so much enthusiasm for them anymore. As our materialistic motives recede, then we may go through a period where we're just like, I don't feel that I'm so good at this anymore, I don't feel that I really enjoy it anymore. And then we have to start doing it in another way. We have to start doing it with attachment for Krishna that rather than for our ego. And sometimes there's those sort of stages. That does happen. Where the way that we motivate ourselves to focus and the way we motivate ourselves stops being a motivator. And there may be an interim period before we learn how to motivate ourselves on a higher level. Does that make sense to you? That seems to be quite common. And again, if I look at Bhagavad Gita, what Krishna was saying to him is, your activities are fine, your motivation is not. And when Arjuna started withdrawing from the materialistic motivation, he went through a period where he just didn't want to do anything at all. And Krishna said, no, you do it in another way. So that may help. Yes.
Yesterday, someone asked a question about, is it possible once we return to Godhead to come back down? Mm. And I found that your reply was very interesting. You said that we could always choose to. So I wanted to know how far does free will go? And on top of that, once we do go back to Godhead, do we cease to be like the soul and we just like merge and become one? Which is something that I've been having difficulty with. Or are we always in relation even when we are back home?
We're always in relation and we always have free will. But in our perfect state, we're both one and distinct. It's both. And one isn't more than the other. We're always like that. Krishna consciousness means to become aware that we're like that. But we always have our free will. That's always. And we're always ourselves. we're not always ourselves as we define ourselves in terms of this lifetime. But we always have a self-identity. Is that okay?
Anything else from that moment?
Yes. In relation to service and sort of finding one's sort of place in Krishna consciousness, I know like book distribution and cooking and prasad, like those are like the main services, but what happens if you sort of aren't so gifted in sort of either one of them? Do you
do what you're gifted in? You know, that's, yes, we have especially the people who are living full-time in the ashrams and they're engaged in that kind of outreach. And everybody can distribute some books and some prasadam. I mean, it's not hard. You can buy some boxes of raisins and offer them and give them to people. You don't have to be some kind of expert chef. And you can give people some books here and there. It's not that you can't do any book distribution, any prasadam distribution, but you can help people to become Krishna conscious through your own talents and your own abilities, whatever they are. What do you like to do? What are you good at?
Well, I'm a trainer, like a personal trainer. So what I'm saying is, cause, I mean, I tried sort of doing that in service and sort of trying to, I guess, train devotees for free and sort of get them, sort of, I guess, without sort of drifting them too far away, but like more sort of bodily conscious, I mean, just sort of taking care of the vehicle we're using to transport the soul kind of thing.
That's Krishna's.
But,
it's Krishna's vehicle.
Sometimes get lost along the way.
That's good. And what about when you're dealing just in your work?
I play kirtan in the gym every once in a while. But, I think where I sort of get lost is if a person has a sort of bad reaction towards it, or they sort of, like if they offend me, I'm never sort of offended, but then I sort of almost like lose it instantly, and I sort of, it almost sort of, it could be counterproductive because it almost seems I could be used as an ambassador of Krishna consciousness or as devotees, but here I am sort of like losing my temper. The other person sort of.
Losing our temper when we get insulted is one of the greatest struggles for a human being. Some things that may help you is to think about, why do we do that? Why do we get angry? Often very quickly. And very severely.
Yeah.
Yes? When we think somebody has offended us or insulted us. Correct? Am I correct? Is that just his problem? So why is that? So if we think about biologically, so we have an urge to live. Well, that's basically because we're an eternal soul. And we define living as being keeping this body alive. Now, how do we keep this body alive? We have to get food, we have to get water, we have to get shelter. As social creatures, this, the particular species of form we inhabit at the present moment is designed to be social. Some creatures are not social creatures, but we are. And therefore, on a strictly physiological, biological level, a lot of our access to physical resources has to do with our status. Higher status people get more resources. Have you noticed this? Everybody notices this, that higher status people get more resources. Insults are taking us down in status. And therefore, at a very primordial level, we feel that our existence and our ability to get what we need is being threatened. It's just like if somebody were threatening your food or your home you know, we go into an automatic defense, which is useful. It's useful. Okay. Somebody's trying to take my food or my home, or to have an instant, no thought required, defensive posture, and it's so fast. You know, what people can do if they're feeling threatened is they get kind of superhuman strength. You're aware of that, right? What's also interesting is that the same neurological pathways that spark that rage also are what's involved in the protector or hero instinct. It's the same thing that, you know, if a kid falls in front of a train, and without thinking, you jump in front of the train, you grab the kid, and you jump up. And later, if someone says, why did you do that? I don't know. I just did it. It's exactly the same chemicals and pathways that when we feel threatened, we become angry. And a lot of what we do when we're threatened is we don't just defend ourselves, we attack. So when we feel insulted or we think that somebody has offended us, we attack. So one thing that helps us to understand what this is, it's a very useful biological mechanism. But most of the time when people are insulting and offending me, I'm not actually being threatened. You know what I'm saying? It's not that I'm really some, you know, animal in a group and some other animal is threatening my position and I might not get the food or the mate or something. That's not actually what's going on. So one thing is to identify what it is, to see it for what it is. Once you see things for what they are, you aid your ability with having this choice space of responsiveness. Does this make sense to everybody? It appears that I'm responding that fast. But there is a choice space there. How do I become aware of that choice space? It's there. Well, first of all, I have to recognize it for things for what they are. That an insult or an offense against me makes me feel this rage and defense and attack because it's triggering a biochemical existence mechanism, which would be extremely useful in some situations. I'd be very glad I had it. Oh, what is this? Is this? Am I really being threatened here? The main way to see that choice gap regularly is to have a consciousness that's out of the modes of passion and ignorance. The lower you are in the modes, the more fearful you are in general of safety. Because the more you're identifying with this world and with this body. So in ignorance, we're not that much better than an animal. And the lower we are in the modes, the less it takes to trigger that I'm threatened response. We're full of fear. As we go up through the modes, our fear lessens because we identify less and less and less with this world. If I identified fully as a soul, I wouldn't be afraid of anything, and I wouldn't feel any need to defend this body or this ego or this reputation with anybody ever because it just would. Krishna's maintaining me, and I'm a soul, and I don't need anything in this world. I'd never feel threatened. You know, I may choose to allow that response as a protector, but I would never need to have that response kick in as an ego defense. So as you go up through the modes, what makes a person have that fear is less and less and less and less and less and less and less. And therefore you respond to those things. It starts taking a really extreme insult and a really extreme threat before you'll respond. That's interesting. As you go up through the modes, if you start getting up into the mode of passion and the mode of goodness, you might go years where you never have that kind of response. And then something is enough for where you are that you do. And you go, oh, I thought I was finished with that. I didn't realize I still had that capability. And then that tells you, oh, that's I've hit my level. Am I making sense to you? I hit my level where fear still kicks in. There's still something I feel threatened by. And you want to ultimately come to the point that we don't feel threatened by anything. Now also, as you go higher up through the modes, you just see how things are working. I like where Krishna talks about Bhagavad Gita 2, 62 and 63, where he says we contemplate things, then we become attached, then we become lusty, then we become angry, then we become bewildered, and we lose our memory. Now that appears to happen again extremely fast. It seems that I just get angry and lose my memory and become bewildered in an instant. And in fact, the Bhagavatam says that. It says that this rage seems to fall out of the sky. But it's not. There are steps happening. The first step is that I think about how I want people to treat me. I set up a picture. You understand? I have a picture of reality as I want it to be. How I want, you know, my clients to treat me or my employers to treat me. And I have this little world. And I contemplate it and I think, yes. And this is how this is how this is. Then I will be happy. We allow ourselves to think about it and to meditate on it. And as we do that, we become attached to it. We think, I need it to be like this. It must be like this. If it's like this, I'll be happy. If it's not, I won't. We do this with very little things. Like, I plan to have the time to do whatever I wanted from 4 to 5 this afternoon. That's my time, and that's what I'm going to do with it. And we have it on a larger scale of, you know, how my family members are going to treat me, and how this is, how my body's going to feel. And we become attached. Then when we become attached, that attachment increases to what Krishna calls lust, where we say, it must be like that. I will not accept it not being like that. Now, once we go to that point, we're in a lot of trouble. Once we become so attached that it must be, that we're not willing to entertain it being anything else, when we've made a firm link between this attachment and our sense of self-preservation and happiness, we form this strong belief. Then when we don't get it, we become angry and we lose our intelligence. We lose our memory. We forget everything we studied. What kind of person we wanted to be, how we wanted to behave, everything that, you know, whatever. We just forget all of it. And then we're later on, oh, why did I say that? Why did I do that? And then you have to see if you can fix it. Sometimes you can't even fix it. So as we go up through the modes, as we come to the mode of passion, the mode of goodness, and ultimately to bhakti, we start to become aware of when the mind goes to the contemplation stage. It's like you see it when it's far away and you recognize it. And you go, oh, I know you. I know you. I know who you are. I know what you do to me. And I'm not going to allow myself to even do that. Now, what's very important, if you look at Bhagavad Gita 2.64, you don't push it away. You don't become averse. You neither contemplate, nor do you reject. You just allow and observe. A big mistake that beginning spiritualists make is they think, if I don't contemplate how I'm going to be happy in this world, then that means I hate it. and I reject it, and I step on it, and I suppress it. But that's just another form of attachment. It doesn't solve your problem at all. And if that's one's technique, one will decide that spiritual life doesn't work. So Krishna's telling us we are the observer. It's not something one becomes. We realize I'm the observer. And this thought and feeling that enter into my consciousness of, if things are like this, then I will be happy, then I will be safe, then I will be respected, then I will get what I want. As soon as those sort of feelings and desires come into the purview, and you recognize, oh, I know you. Your illusion. Well, I'm not feeding you. If you want to hang out, hang out. But I'm not feeding you. I'm not talking to you. I'm not giving you a place to stay. You stay as long as you like, but I'm not facilitating. Now, what should happen by chanting Hare Krishna is that ability should come basically automatically. You should start noticing that it's happening. That the ability to perceive things in a very beginning stage. The first time I planted flowers, you say you plant flowers. First time I planted flowers, oh my goodness, this is so embarrassing. I just took all the marigold and zinnia seeds and I just put them in the ground. And so, I mean, I did go through the ground first, cleared everything out, made a patch that looked like it was just dirt. Anyway, when the little seedlings came up, I couldn't tell what was a marigold because I didn't have any experience. So I couldn't tell what was a marigold, what was a zinnia, and what was a weed. There was just this green carpet. And I had to wait until they were bigger before I could do anything. So as you go up through the modes and as you come to bhakti, you can recognize these things when they're very tiny. Oh, I know you. You're the seedling of rage. I know you. I'm like, not giving you water and fertilizer. And that ability should just come. But you do also want to make sure that what you want to look at is for the beginning. And if you can't recognize in the beginning, at least train yourself that this is a wonderful biological reaction meant to protect me, that I don't need to have kicking in this place because I'm really not threatened. I'm really, my existence and my life resources are really not threatened by this person being nasty to me. I'm dependent on Krishna to maintain me. I'm not dependent on this person. And if you practice that, it gets easier and easier and easier and easier and easier. The first time you practice it, you may have the feelings inside. All the feelings may be boiling. And you're there with your intelligence saying, Krishna's maintaining me. Krishna's maintaining me. I'm a soul. I'm a soul. I'm a soul. Krishna's maintaining me. Krishna's maintaining me. I do not need to respond with rage to this. And as you practice, it gets easier and easier and easier. And then the feelings come up less and less and less and less and less. And when they come, they come and then they go. Is that all right?
Thank you so much, G. I was wondering, I'm in a position where during the week I'm very privileged to have daily access to BYS and I have my own space at university. I can have as many deities, I can chant as often as I want, play kirtan as much as I want. Surrounded by people who are very accepting of my faith and willing to engage in conversation surrounding that. And then on the weekends I come home to a home environment where that kind of behaviour is not welcome to the point where it frustrates and angers those in my home environment. And I wanted to ask you, I know that my responsibility as someone who has who I feel is getting a stronger relationship with Krishna, to not associate with that kind of anger and that sort of frustration, not allow it to affect me. But my question is, how do I do that without letting the people around me who are my family members, how do I make sure that they don't feel rejected or pushed away by my...
Okay, so yeah. You're doing exactly what I talked about. You're pushing away. Mm. As I said, beginners often do that. They often feel the way to deal with attachment and anger and frustration is to push it away and become cold. But that's another form of attachment. It's still thinking, the way these people are dealing with me is essential to my happiness. I'm dependent on how these people are dealing with me in order to be happy, in order to be safe, in order to be fulfilled. And so if they don't deal with me the way that I want, and if I can't physically walk away, then I'm going to emotionally walk away and turn off my heart. But suppose the way these people are treating you has nothing to do with your happiness at all.
If you wish to bring Krishna consciousness into their lives.
Well, first you got to take care of yourself before you do that. So, you have to take care of yourself first. So first it's got to be, Krishna's meeting my needs. I'm not dependent on these people to meet my needs. If I feel I'm dependent on certain other people to meet my needs, then I'm going to go through this, what we call Bhoga Tyaga. If I feel they're meeting my needs, then I love them and I like to be with them, and if I feel they're not, I harden my heart to them. So, but other people aren't meeting your needs. It's Krishna meeting your needs, not them. It's not your family, it's not your friends, it's not anybody. It's only Krishna. It's only ever been Krishna. And to meditate on that and to feel that and to remind yourself of that. I am already full in connection with the full. I'm not needy, I'm not empty, I don't have any need for anyone to deal with me in any particular way to be satisfied. Will you feel that way immediately, totally? No, but at least you can work on it. And at least you can see that that's the problem. That the problem isn't the way they're dealing with you. And you can guard against both, you know, wanting to have them as your source of happiness and becoming cold-hearted. If Krishna is meeting my needs, then I can be loving with everybody. Because I don't need to get anything from them. And I'm not dependent on what they think of me or what they give of me. You know, it doesn't matter. Then I can be nice to everybody. Some people are dangerous and I shouldn't be around them. That's a practical one. There is a practical matter that some people are dangerous and I should remove myself physically from their environment if I have the ability to do so. But as far as being, you can only really be loving and giving with everybody if you are already fulfilled. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Then your relationships with others are on the platform of freedom. Then you're actually loving them. Not using them. You don't need to use them. You're already filled. You already have what you need. Even if you can't do that 100% today, theoretically we could, but practically, usually we can't. Then at least we can understand, oh, my frustration, my hardening, my heart is coming from this problem. And that's a big step. It's a big step to lessening the frustration with the other people. Oh, it's coming from the problem that I'm not feeling connected with Krishna. I'm not feeling satisfied. And therefore I'm thinking that I need these people to satisfy me. Because I think I need these people to satisfy me. If they're satisfying me, I'm loving with them. And if they're not, I'm cold. And then you go, yuck. What an awful way to deal with others. Is that all right? Yes.
My question has to do with...
That was a nice kirtan, by the way. Thank you.
We hear Prabhupada almost daily and we read in the books how we're not the body, we're the soul. How important is it for us to get into... What's the import of that? Because sometimes you get... then the devotee says, I know that already, I'm not the body, I'm the soul. What would be the symptom of actually one who knows that? Do we ever get past that? I know that I'm not this body, I'm the soul.
Yeah, I was talking to one devotee the other day who was telling me something, not that, but something. And I said, yeah, I know that. And the devotee said, stop saying you know anything. What do you know? What do you really know? How are you going to get anywhere if you think you already know everything? If we know that we're not the body, that we know that we're the soul, then we're not going to identify with the things of this body, and things that threaten our bodily identification and mental identification will not upset us. If we're identifying as just Krishna's, you can't just identify as a soul. That doesn't work very well. I am the soul. That's a good start. But you can't really function on that platform. So if I'm identifying as Krishna's, I'm Krishna's employee, I'm Krishna's secret agent, I work for him. You know, if you're a spy for the South African government in North Korea, and you're there and you have a job as a car salesman or something, or as an English teacher, you're not there to sell cars or teach English. You're there to spy for your country. So people talking about, you know, how good of a car salesman you are, you don't really care. You're not there to be a car salesman. You're not invested in that identity. You don't really care how many cars you sell. You're only trying to sell enough cars to keep your cover job. You understand? Because it's not really the car dealership that's paying your salary. Your government's paying your salary, secretly. You don't have any attachment to how many cars you sell. It's just a practical thing. So when we identify that I'm Krishna's agent, that I'm Krishna's, we're not affected by the results in this world. We don't identify with them. We're not happy in gain and devastated in loss. We're not affected by honor and dishonor and success and failure and fame and infamy. We're not affected by any of those things because that's all we're trying to get. We have another mission. So if somebody really knows they're not the body, then that's the evidence, is that they'll be very equipoised. They'll be really, really equipoised. And of course, once you really know that you're a soul, you start knowing about, well, who am I specifically? And that should awaken at some point in Krishna consciousness, depending on a lot of factors. Can't be forced. But at a certain point, that wakes up, and you start realizing not just that I'm a soul, but, you know, oh, I'm a coward boy. Name such and such. And this is what my eternal body looks like. This is my color. And this is the clothes I like to wear. This is the color hair I have. And this is the service that I do. That starts waking up. And then you're existing on a completely different plane. Is that right? We are late.
Yeah. So.
We have prasadam?
Yeah, we do.
I assume we're not going to eat here on the rug, are we?
Yeah, it feels.
Eat outside?
Well, there's big spaces.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we could eat outside. If you have any cloth or something.
Yeah.
Put outside. And you have a nice backyard.
Yeah.
I want to do. Thank you all for coming. I hope this was helpful.
Thank you. And,